I am delighted to welcome Anant Sharma, founder and CEO of Matter of Form. Matter of Form is a London-based brand and experience design consultancy that you have led for 15 years now. You look so young. Oh, my God. Under Anant's direction, Matter of Form has become known for working with ambitious brands across luxury, travel, hospo, and a lifestyle, helping them translate heritage and craft into contemporary cultural relevance, exactly what this series is about. You've built a practice that fuses narrative, behavioral design, strategy. You co-own Experience House, a design school that is shaping the next generation of creatives. You co-host a podcast, which was actually how I found you. The podcast is What the Lux. And in 2023, you were appointed a trustee of the UK's Craft Council. So one thing that I love when I heard you talking about this, and then when I went to the Matter of Form website, is that you insist that brands need to stop chasing luxury as a label and instead strive for timelessness. And as a marketer, something that we always laugh about with our branding partners is that brands need to focus on timelessness while marketing often needs to focus on timeliness. And I think that that intersection of the two and how we actually foster campaigns, work together, and build brands that are resilient and stand the test of time is so super important. So welcome. I'm delighted to have you here with me today.
Well, thank you, Polly. I might have to steal that introduction because it's better than I've ever introduced myself. So thank you for that. I feel flattered. And also I thought that was well put about the timelessness and timely point. I agree. Marketing needs to feel timely. Brands need to feel timeless. I think it's important in the context of luxury because luxury, I feel over the last 10 years, has almost become a qualifying search term. It's become mid-market. It's a way of figuring out whether the thing that you're looking for is actually driven by design and quality, whether it's driven by R&D, or whether it's driven by a desire for engineering excellence, whether it's a desire for just making the best product rather than necessarily the product that has the greatest scale. And I think there's a difference between the two. So for me, in a world that is moving very, very quickly, where fads come and go, where tastes and preferences change incredibly quickly, striving to have some form of long-term appeal is really vital. And I think luxury and whatever it stands for, timelessness, the concept of it is important because we're heading into a world where we run the risk of being caught in an endless cycle of consumerism. And that applies as much to fast fashion as it does to fast fads that are true of almost every category and sector. You know, we manufacture desire, we optimize content to feed an algorithm that then feeds back into the manufacturing of that desire. And so we can be bystanders to that cycle, which I think is a terrible race to commoditization, or we can create things that, you know, have some sort of lasting value and impact. And that for me is the noble endeavor of luxury today, even though that category, as I said before, has almost become a search term. It's become very wide. I think it's important.
I think it's interesting because whenever we use the word luxury when we're working with a brand, we say that's never a public-facing word. Like if you want to use that language somewhere, you know, in internal docs or just in slang in the background because you're working quickly and everybody understands it, that's fine. But luxury nowadays feels, I'm just going to say, it feels very crass. Like anyone who works in luxury spaces or particularly in hospitality spaces, I think feels this sense that there's more to good brands, timeless brands, than slapping a big ticket price tag on it. So you've had 15 years though, working with Matter of Form and working with these brands. Like, was this a conviction that evolved over time? Like, did you get in, say, I have a book that's been in my bookshelf for 25 years that's How to Be a Graphic Designer Without Selling Your Soul. Like, did you actually get into agency work with a different perspective on brand building? And then you saw something over time that brought you to this point that you're like, we can't build junk. We can't build consumerism, even if it does have that high price tag on it.
You know, my journey's been an interesting one. I barely ever worked in an agency, and I didn't work in the world of luxury. When I started the company, we were an innovation business, and we used to, at that time, a lot of innovation was digital. So we used to specialize in helping create disruptive ventures, creating digital platforms or digital products for large organizations. And we would do one of two things. We would either keep the intellectual property transparently and build spin-off ventures from the insight that we garnered through working with a client who had identified a problem, or we would take sweat equity positions with industry veterans turned entrepreneurs and help them de-risk the process of digitizing their idea, their digital first idea. And so, you know, the first third of my career was innovation. And like I said, that mostly meant digital innovation. The second period of my career was moving into doing that for larger organizations and moving away from the sweat equity slash incubation model, which is emotionally draining and doesn't lead to a prosperous life. I'll put it that way. And so the second stage of our life was digital transformation. And we gravitated towards luxury brands for one key reason. And that was that we, I think, had more brand empathy to assert to the types of luxury brands where luxury companies, they value their brand above all else. You know, that's the thing that is that a lot of their value is within their brand. And so, you know, we would compete against quite blunt instrument digital agencies who were focused on optimization. And we were focused on the brand strategy process that you need to go through to understand how, you know, you prioritize different types of content on your site or what services to digitize when you're going through that transformation. And I stood as a bystander to this terrible over-optimization of everything. And it was that optimization that I watched strip the brand and the joy and the delight and sometimes the process out of luxury brands that were left with very little meaning. And it was at that point that I realized that actually our future was as a is taking our innovation mindset but applying it to branding and to working with the C-suite to reimagine what their organizations might mean in the future, what that future looked like, and how to innovate in a way that wasn't gimmicky and that understood human emotion as much as whatever connotations the word innovation might have. And so, you know, we moved into what we do. The pathway was from innovation through digital and into brand. And then the innovation mindset and our background gave us a framework for thinking about brand experience. It was more choreography than brand book. And so, you know, looking at the sequence of touch points in every interaction and the behavioral dynamics that sit behind each of those interactions, and then the sort of connective tissue that joins all of those interactions together, and the concept of value that all of those things, when working in harmony, the concept of value that that all creates.
So I want to talk about the choreography, but I actually want to go back to something you said. So our take on it was always that we wanted to be able to do good work. You know, like we actually wanted to be able to live up to our potential and grow. Like that notion of being one of those people, as you say, who sit there. And I know the kind of agencies that you're talking about, that everything has the soul optimized out of it. Like there was one moment when I got so frustrated that on our site, the tagline, this was years ago, that was like, we build wine brands with soul. I was like, you know what? If there's not something there, if there's not, I mean, we can say a sense of timelessness, but if there isn't a reason for being that sits behind what you're doing, it actually can make it really, really difficult to work well with clients and to be on the same page and ultimately to work in a long relationship with them. Because like wine or luxury, wine, hospitality, anything that's craft-based, what we want to do is we want to make certain that we aren't diluting that brand through keyword optimization bullshit and ads that get the fastest turnaround tomorrow, but are absolutely demolishing the brand over time. So I want to come into the choreography part of it, because this is language that you've used a lot in your presentations, and it's on the matter of form site, and it's this brand experience as this collection of touch points. So can you kind of talk about what that's meant for you when you are doing the real work day to day?
Yeah, I think it's worth just setting some context to the comment, you know, and it's we used to live in a much flatter world. You know, we had a billboard that advertised our brand. We had a brand book that provided governance on how that brand should work in different contexts.
We had a nice tidy five-step tunnel that, you know, or funnel
Funnel, exactly. You know, we knew where our, we had maybe a clearer sense of where our audience was. And when our audience was different, we could adapt our message slightly to cater for the needs we knew were appropriate to them. But in a digital first world, we're sort of exposed online, aren't we? You know, we have to have a pretty clear sense of who we are. But by having that very clear sense of who we are, enabled by digital, we also have access to a global audience. So the tables have sort of switched a little bit, right? You know, sort of we have a bigger audience, but we have to have a more narrow niche. and we have to have the confidence to do both of those things. So with all of that, you know, we have to consider how we interact with brands. We're not just looking at a billboard. We're not just looking at one place. We move through a journey, a dance with the brand. And we have more touch points than ever before. I think it's estimated by Google that there's about 250,000 touch points between a consumer and a category before they make a purchase within that category, or something like that, some absolutely astronomical figure. Now, I think like people who come from the sort of, you know, advertising agency mindset or the old school mindset, you know, would assume that to cut through all the noise, we need to shout louder. But actually, the truth of psychology is that we're making decisions based on the nuance and the detail. You know, we're making decisions based on, you know, the PPC ad that you referenced that has no sensitivity to the brand or the brand book, that's focused just on conversion in that one place rather than building the right type of associations over the long term. Our concept of value is broken by the poorly designed email template. Our sense of the Airbnb that we might be booking is qualified by the light switch and the quality of the flooring, not necessarily the color of the sea. You know, and so we're making these decisions in the background without even realizing it. But they're not the easy to measure decisions, and they're not the decisions that each of the individual practitioners or departments would necessarily measure their own sort of silo success in silo upon. And so when I talk about the choreography, it's the fact that the customer moves through every department in a business, but companies aren't structured that way. You know, you have different departments within their business, but the customer moves, you know, across product, across PR, across search, across brand, across, you know, out of home and into digital, from e-commerce into loyalty. You know, the customer moves across all of these things. And so we need to write a story or a journey for how the customer moves across all of these things. We need to think of it as a choreography or a dance. We need to think about the type of sentiment that we want to leave the customer with as they move through the different stages of the experience. And that moves from marketing, from brand into marketing, and then into physical experience, particularly in the case of categories like hospitality. But, you know, retail is just as important as it moves from transaction to theater, and then into loyalty, and like what we want to leave people with and what that peak end moment is like that ultimately will turn, you know, the people who become loyal to us into our greatest advocates and the cheapest marketing dollar that we could spend. So, you know, all of these things need to come together in sort of symphony. And if you get that right by taking a step back and designing the vision for the customer and how he moves, how he or she, you know, moves through your brand and your product, you'll have a far leakier bucket.
Yeah. So back in the day, I did a mini series on empathy, like strictly on empathy, because the space that we live in, and this comes up, I feel like it comes up in every one of these podcasts where we're talking about culture and relevance, is that empathy is at the heart of much of what you're talking about, right? And that as marketers, it's our job to sit in the room in that customer space and actually be the voice or the advocate for that customer. And I'll tell a story. We did work with a major, major brand. It was probably a year's worth of due diligence. And one of the things that happened, so it was in the end, the work was ultimately just websites, right? But to get to that moment of the website, we flew out. We had representatives from every one of their business units in the room talking through the experience, and like literally accounting had never sat in the same room with inventory before, or with the people who were managing the ERP, or with the C-suite who were paying for what they needed. And I think that there were hours that we just sat there as the facilitators so that they could understand what the business units needed to get out of it. So that by the time the brief came to us for what is, you know, quote unquote, just a website, that it actually said, okay, these are the functions that the business needs to get. And how do we translate that into something that is empathetic to what the customer is trying to do the minute that they land anywhere with that brand? And also having to push back against things that, you know, this happens all the time. Well, you do understand that if you do that, that doesn't feel like what you're stating.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a website isn't really a website. It's an exercise in organizing what's important.
I know.
It
encapsulates everything about your brand, every way that you feel about your customers, how you feel about yourself, you know, where you exist in the wider world.
If you think about, you know, and I think it's harder to position and deliver, for example, a website or a brand for a B2B organization than it is for a B2C. You know, I find that it's, maybe that's not true, actually. Who knows? There are challenges with both, but B2B businesses have typically, you know, sold what they need to sell in person with sales representatives, and the message has been adapted and the service set has been altered. Whereas you're naked online, you know, you can't be everything to everyone, and it's impossible to do a website without figuring out a hierarchy of importance of department, of service set, of you know, of positioning and of understanding who your target audience is. And when I say understanding who your target audience is, you know, I don't just mean like, you know, the segment that you're going after and, you know, all of the sort of, you know, the person who's married or not married with kids or not kids and what their wealth bracket, you know.
The bullshit personas.
Whatever about that stuff. What's really important is seeing the world through the eyes of your customer. And there's a definition of an insight that's always stayed with me, and that is an insight is the difference between what people say and how they act. There's quite a good example, actually, that always stayed with me, and it's from IDEO, the human-centered design firm that anyone in our industry would be familiar with. They invented the mouse for Apple back in the 80s. And they were asked to revitalize the patient experience for a high-end US hospital group. And all of the C-suite knew what was going to come back. They were going to have a beautiful lobby. This was an expensive hospital. You know, it was going to be marble floors, and it was going to be a beautiful exercise in interior opulence. And IDEO came back and they played a video that was just of the ceiling for 6 minutes in a boardroom, and all of the board members and exec leadership were outraged. You know, what is this video? You know, it was a cracked yellowing ceiling. And, you know, I think their point was, you know, 60% of your customers, this is what they see when they're wheeled into a hospital, or whatever the percentage was, I'm sure, perhaps a bit less than 60%. I'm not sure everyone's on their back when they enter a hospital, but, and you know, it's perhaps turned into one of those sort of mythological examples, but that probably gets slightly exaggerated every time it's retold. But the point is a good one, which is you do forget what it's like to see your experience through the eyes of your customer. You need to go and like live on the floor.
So I suppose on the one hand, we can talk about how we need to make everything empathetic, customer centric, but at the same time, you've gone on the record for talking about how friction is actually important as part of the experience. And honestly, those two things feel at odds with one another. Can you explain what you mean by that when you say, you know, there is a value in friction, and some kinds of friction can create a richness or a resonance with an audience or a brand?
Sure. I think, you know, we have, as a human race species, you know, for centuries optimized life through technology. And so we can get quite caught up in thinking the thing that represents good is also about having less friction or having an easier path to an endpoint. But what is luxury if not about felt experience? If not about connecting with your environment, with the people around you, frankly, with yourself? And I think those things have become incredibly important because we live so much of our lives online, because we've stripped the community out of different aspects of life, whether it's, you know, in the Western world in particular, a more secular direction that people have taken, whether it's the fact that we don't go to 5 different stores and know the store owners to buy our groceries and can go to a supermarket, but even that is now Uberized directly into our homes. It's, you almost have to be irrational to do the everyday things that brought joy and created the happenstance or social, serendipitous social connection that feeds all of our soul. And so in a way, luxury provides a rational reason to do the irrational, which is indulge things. And by indulging them, justify a slower path, place value on it. And through the act of doing all of those things, connect with nature, connect with, you know, what we eat, those we love, find enjoyable and slow ways to spend our time. And there are so many movements around this, you know, whether it's slow food or, you know, there are in New York clubs to read books in parks. And, you know, there's a generation of people who are beginning to understand what the loss of the analog means at a spiritual level.
So when you say friction, though, you're not talking about us being pissed off because when you go into an Hermes store now, you have to wait in line out front and then you have to go inside and then you have to wait for somebody to help you. And now you've got, like, you know, you've got the quota bags. Like, it's not a sense of friction in customer service, or is it?
Or when you're put on a waiting list for a Birkin bag. There's actually an antitrust case in L.A., you know, just for
two women got pissed off because they couldn't get their Birkin bag. I know.
It's just so, you know, and I'm afraid that that's a part of luxury that I find rather ridiculous, which is sort of engineered scarcity. I think, you know, the beauty of something being scarce is the fact that it's scarce due to limited, you know, material or resource, or
it's
because
made with
that's
our hands. We only have so much time.
Exactly.
I know.
Because that skill is actually, you know, hard to cultivate, you know, rather than this engineered scarcity that I think will ultimately be the undoing of a lot of large luxury brands who are beginning to be viewed as fairly complacent.
This is not on script. It wasn't one of my questions, but of course, you know, I have to ask the question about AI.
Yeah.
And where does AI fit in this notion of slow and handmade and restricted resources and really what I would just describe as mindful production? And we see this with luxury brands all over the place. I mean, I'm coming to London next week and I'm coming with my youngest daughter. She's of legal drinking age, I have to say that, and she's a cocktail drinker. And so I asked her, did she want to go to the Velvet Lounge at Corinthia? And I was like, where all of their drinks are art meets AI. Like, what's the thought of it? So we even have cocktails that are being generated by AI recipes. Like, where is this going? Because I've got some really, really strong opinions on this in my industry, but I'd like to know what your thoughts are.
You know, I think there are many ways to answer this, but I was recently doing a talk about AI, and I'd sort of, through the process of researching what I was going to talk about, come across a business, I think they're called Loi Loi or something like this, that they 3D print antique rugs. And so with the rug has a level of, you know, sort of degradation to it that's supposed to represent its age, but basically it's a new rug. And it really got me thinking, you know, which is story and the provenance and the soul of a thing, you know, is, you know, that's what makes a like a beautiful rug feel beautiful, right? You know that it's seen some things, and you can recreate that, but it's sort of like an empty calorie. It's not satisfying for very long. And
I think we can use AI to, you know, to scrape data sets. Robbie Barrett did this with one of the famous designers he created, you know, synthesized collections based on previous fashion designers' work. We can do all of this type of stuff, but I think ultimately we will become more interested in the process and the journey and all of the things that lead up to that point of expression rather than the thing itself. And I think that will become like the sort of form of status that we value.
Well, there are AI artists who argue that there is craft in their ability to produce. I don't know if you remember the case maybe 18 months, 2 years ago, where I think it was in Colorado, an AI piece of art won at an art jury, and there was absolute outrage of it. And of course, we've just had like Cannes Lions and the issue with AI ads that have then had to be stripped of the awards that they were given. How do people who have a love affair with the things that are handmade, you know, that are timeless, that are created so that we can pass them down to our grandchildren, grandchildren's grandchildren, right? How do we counter that argument that they're like, but it takes skill. It takes skill and craft, and I'm trying to build something beautiful as well, but I'm using AI to do it.
I think it's a crisis of meaning, Holly. I think it's there's no easy answer. You know, I think it's become so difficult to create a rational reason to do the harder thing, which is spend more money on the handmade, or even to learn how to make the thing with your hands. And I think the more technology optimizes life, the harder it is to clutch onto those rational reasons for doing what you do. But when you find one of those rational reasons, I find people really clutch onto them. You know, I did a podcast with Kef, the speaker company. They make amazing audio equipment, and you know, we got into a conversation about, you know, digitization of audio, you know, and you know, which they're embracing. But audiophiles hate the digitization of audio because there's a great tribal charm to sitting around a record and listening to the imperfections and the crackle, and just knowing that it is, you know, amplified from physical object, you know, that actually contains within it the song encoded, the music encoded.
And that those are often choices that the artists have made. I mean, artists select recording environments for how literally that environment impacts the final recording. And, you know, my same daughter can talk to you about it's Portishead's Dummy album that got beaten to shit right before it actually went to print, because it got, you know, like run over and all of these things to give it a very specific sound that creates something that is wholly unique, again, from sort of a, sorry Swifties, but kind of that pop soullessness of it, you know, that is so smooth and so refined. I'm completely getting off topic because there were so many things that I wanted to talk with you about. I want to talk about desire. I want to talk about this desire and aspiration. So you work with quite a lot of very high-end hotel brands. So you work with Aman, you work with Belmond. I find how modern branding and marketing is approaching aspiration is absolutely shifting in terms of relevance and the audience, and trying to walk a fine line between inclusive but exclusive. So how do you juxtapose these things or balance them all out?
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's an interesting and fairly difficult to answer question, actually, because luxury isn't inclusive, but nothing really is. Nothing that gives people a sense of belonging is inclusive, and that's the great quandary of it all. You know, you can be, we were working a while ago on a members club that was focused on social well-being. And yeah, it's ironic because you're a members club, so you're exclusive, but you're about people brought together by a desire to, you know, help sort of inclusion. And so, you know, there are always going to be these tensions, you know. But what we're really all looking for is to find a common thread between those we gather with, and to have that as a starting point to connect with each other, to have some sort of shared interest or shared spiritual values. And so, you know, And of course, you know, different degrees of wealth are, of course, going to play a part in shaping people's life experiences and obviously enabling them to do certain things and not do other things. You know, that's just a truth of capitalism that we can't ignore. And luxury is not that inclusive because it tends to be the preserve of those who can afford it. But, you know, the subsets of that.
But you can have a timeless brand, just to be fair, you can have a timeless brand that's not a luxury brand. You know, like the one that comes to mind, I know it's quite tropey, but you think about Patagonia, right? The Patagonia feels like a brand that absolutely is timeless. And, or, you know, what they've stood for. Ben and Jerry's, funnily enough, especially with everything that's going on this week, Ben and Jerry's is 100% a timeless brand within its category. And there's nothing that has to do with luxury at all. But buying Ben and Jerry's right now for some people is, in fact, a political act.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, timeless brands are brands that have a strong sense of self and a focus on quality and pushing things and doing the best that they can possibly do and caring about design and the psychology of the experience and leaving people feeling a little bit better about the act of consumerism they've engaged in. Someone once said every act of consumerism is an act of self-expression. It's true. You know, we don't need any of this stuff, but we do it because it gives us joy and allows us to express ourselves, it engages us, it gives us delight. And so, you know, I think we need to be honest about that and then buy into brands who care about that. And for me, that's really important. And you can have, you know, a great value exchange with these brands and have great experience the portfolio of products we buy and the experiences we wear almost as if they are products on our social feed these days, or, you know, however else we, you know, these are ways of signaling, expressing and connecting, you know, and I think it's, I actually really like it.
In the beginning, you were talking about how, you know, it used to be back in the day, or if you're doing B2B sales, you're in front of somebody and you can adapt the messaging on the fly to what they need to hear. But now we need to have messaging that is accessible to, but also visible to all audiences. So when you're working with a brand to maybe say it's an established brand and they're trying to understand what the next 100 years looks like, how do you actually work with them to develop messaging that is transparent? And by that, I mean truthful and trustworthy, that is on brand across different hemispheres, different generations, or simply different psychographics, like different affinity groups. Where do you stop and say you're trying to reach too many people or do too many things?
Yeah, I think obviously we work with luxury brands, you know, whether we like the term or not, you know, and I dislike it, but I have to use it to position what we do. We work with, you know, brands that are premium or luxury, and most of them have been, most of them have some sort of maverick spirit at their heart. They have a founding spirit. They have a strong personality. They have someone who wanted to do something differently. That's as true of Louis Vuitton. Yeah, and they were innovators, you know, and they had eccentric personalities. And, you know, Louis Vuitton, you know, invented round luggage that could roll onto a horse and cart. Ettore Bugatti made a car, you know, someone tried to return it because the brakes failed. He said he made cars to go, not to stop, and ushered the person out of his factory. So we try, rather than resting on the laurels of history and heritage, to go back to that founding spirit and try and think about what the world might look like and method act that person and synthesize a world or scenarios that the business is currently in as they might be imagined through that person. Because often that spirit is lost when the business of luxury becomes operationalized at scale. And somewhere through that process, you end up manufacturing scarcity. You end up, you know, attempting to replicate creativity. I mean, look at the fashion world today. It's a disaster. You know, there's a revolving door of creative directors just moving from one company to the other.
And they're celebrities and they're chosen for publicity reasons. And yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, who's like Will Smith's son is now the creative director of Dior, right? As of the other day.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting.
It's fairly interesting. I haven't really looked into it enough to have that much of an opinion on it, other than I was surprised. But the point of all of this is that you need to go back to go forwards, and you need to look at that spirit, and you need to have a bit of fun with what the world might look like today and what that person might be doing if they're around today. And the second thing you need to do is think about what business you would be in 100 years and take a really long view and then start cycling back from that. Because people today, there's a very high level of job churn. There's a very, very near-term perspective on what good looks like. And that results in a 1 or 2 year view. And that actually strips the ambition out of the strategy. And so I think take a really long view and then work back.
I agree with all of that. I love that what you said about heritage, because this notion, you know, of the implicit versus the explicit, like the what can we understand about what that founder's vision was, and why do we actually need to have that at the core of our brand? So I saw the head of digital innovation for LVMH, a woman named Letitia. Oh shit, I just completely Roche Grenet. Talk about this. She was talking about, of course, because LVMH has the big innovation hub. They've got all of the basically like startups who participate in it. And they also, they don't control the houses in an umbrella fashion, right? Every house gets to make their own decision. But what she was saying is that, of course, they're presented with an absolute ton of ideas, and that every house has to look at it and determine, is this an innovation that is in line with what you're talking about, which is that original spirit of the brand? So is this an innovation? Is this a decision? Is this a move that would have been made by our founders? A lot of my clients would struggle with that, though, because that's not why they went into the wine business. I mean, like, if we look at the wine business, it's a lot of people who made a lot of money. I mean, it's not all, right? Of course, this is such a generalization. We've got gorgeous heritage brands in wine, and some of them are really struggling with understanding what that heritage play looks like. But we also have a lot of them who are like, I love wine and I made a whole lot of money in tech, and I'm going to go out and build myself a winery, and I'm going to buy some land in Napa. And that's really hard because they didn't start with a dream or a spirit or a goal, or, you know, they started with a romantic ideal of owning a winery.
Yeah. I mean, America is very different to Europe in that respect, in that, you know, owning a winery is like a form of status, and, you know, it's a vanity project, and that's not to say the wine isn't great and that these aren't amazing endeavors, but you just don't have that to the same effect in Europe. You know, which is the very old winemaking families that have, you know, treated it as a form of agriculture, really, and so it's very, very different, and so these stories do tend to exist in a different kind of way in European luxury, just by being just older and more rooted in tradition in the past. And there are many positives and also many negatives to that that can be quite asphyxiating. But
I mean, I think it comes back to something that you said about curiosity, right? I think that my experience has been the best brands that evolve, and if you want to use the word innovate in the true sense of the word, the brands that innovate are either led by or have fostered an internal culture of curiosity. Like, I think that the curiosity part of it is so vital. I interviewed Max Cantilia this week, and one of the things that he was talking about, because, you know, we're talking about like spatial web and metaverse and all of these things like this, is that you don't have to ship everything that you do. You can try things. You can learn about things. You can experiment with something behind the scenes to see, what can it do for you? And does it resonate internally? You don't have to do everything. And I think this is a real issue that we have right now with the world living online, is this sense of, if I do something, I have to talk about it, as opposed to, you know what? My team can be curious, and we can invest in training, and we can invest in experimentation. And that even that quote of fail better, it is okay to try things and it not work. And that's so much more essential than never trying anything at all and ending up being these brands that were relevant to our parents' generation, but none of us have ever heard of.
I think you need a controlled demolition zone. you need to understand that innovation is inherently wasteful, and you know, you need to create a culture that celebrates or doesn't become disheartened by failure. I know everyone talks about, it's very popular in culture, isn't it, to talk about failure being a great thing. If failure is not a great thing, but failure there needs to be a tolerance for failure, and what's really important in the failure being a great thing point is not the fact that failure is great, but rather that, you know, it shouldn't stop you not trying. And
for a lot of internal teams, that you feel like you are not going to lose your job because you made a recommendation or because you've tried something or because you've experimented. I mean, I do think that we lose a lot of creative spirit in businesses where, especially if we're going to talk about generationally, you know, I think it was World Economic Forum a few months back that did a breakdown, it might have been HBR, that did a breakdown on the need for leadership, for like literally bringing people and bringing younger people into leadership roles simply because of the relevance and creative spirit that they can bring to their organizations. And we can't grow if we're afraid to fuck up.
Yeah. Exactly.
That wrap-up question that I have to ask, like, if you're looking at those brands who are walking in the door right now and you've got advice for the one brand that says, okay, I'm here for the long haul, like, make it happen. You do your magic and tell me what you need from me. Like, what is the advice for that brand who wants to be here in 50 and 75 years? Where do they start on that path?
If you're starting a brand today from nothing, I would go back to my definition and insight, which is observe how people behave and try and evaluate the difference between how they behave and what they say, because in that gap is opportunity. And understand what that opportunity is, and then don't let it go. Double down on it, focus on it, create something that's niche and globally lovable. Not something that's lovable by those directly around you.
I love that. Thank you. Go be free.
Thank you very much.